Welcome back to my podcast. Oh, I'm hearing an echo. I'm hoping we're okay. but I hope that everybody enjoyed your summer vacation and is getting ready or is back to it at work. We're really, really super excited to be back again with a guest that everybody has been kind of asking us about. So we're like, yay! multiple people have been looking for Dr. Flanagan. So, and also, I wanted to point out that we made a little promo video that was kind of Game of Thrones theme. So if you haven't seen that already, check that out. But Rebecca is running a little bit late. We're hoping she's going to pop on in a little bit. So I'm going to tell you how to participate. So if you're watching through YouTube, you should see a little chat box to the side where you can put your questions, comments, anything that you like, and we'll try and read some out as they come in. And you can also participate through Twitter using the hashtag #PsychPodcast. But my name is Rachel. I'm a school psychologist in Maryland, and I'm going to turn it over to Anna. Anna?
Hi, I'm Anna, school psychologist in New York State. We did a little poll on our Facebook page to find out from you guys how you'd participate in this episode of the podcast, which we are so excited for. So the majority of people are busy on Sunday nights. And, you know, there's football and all sorts of other things going on, but they'll watch it later on YouTube. We also had 26 votes for people who would wait for iTunes. They podcast on the go, which is awesome. And then we had 22 votes for people who are planning on tuning in live tonight on YouTube Live. So hello to the 22 plus or minus 10 of you out there. We're excited that you're here because I get to introduce our fabulous guest, Dr. Dawn Flanagan. Dr. Dawn P. Flanagan is professor of psychology at St. John's University, New York, and affiliate clinical professor at Yale Child Study Center, Yale University School of Medicine. She serves as an expert witness, SLD consultant, and test measurement consultant and trainer for organizations nationally and internationally. Her recent books include Essentials of Specific Learning and Disability Identification, second edition, Essentials of WISC-5 Assessment, Clinical Use and Interpretation of the WJ-4, and Essentials of Planning, Selecting, and Tailoring Interventions for Unique Learners. Dr. Flanagan is also an author of the Cross-Battery Assessment Software System, XBATH. She is fellow of the American Psychological Association and a diplomat of the American Board of Psychology Specialties. She's recently received APA's Division 16 inaugural contributions to practice award. Her forthcoming book includes Essentials of SLD Identification, second edition, and Contemporary Intellectual Assessment, fourth edition. Wow, so many acronyms, so little time. How do you do it, Dr. Flanagan? And thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
There's the cat.
Yeah. Okay. So, ready to go?
Yeah, sure. Walk us through. I think we'll have plenty of questions as you go, but I know you have a little bit of a PowerPoint for us.
Okay. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about cross-battery assessment, its corresponding software system, and a little bit about tailoring assessments using cross-battery to inform SLD diagnosis, and linking findings to intervention. I want to mention that we have my colleagues and I have a 21-hour continuing ed course on cross-battery assessment and XBAS. So it's 18 hours of web-based instruction and then 3 hours of consultation. So my only point in mentioning that is that I have less than an hour here, and we've needed 18 hours to talk about all of these issues. So I'm going to do the best I can to just broad stroke and highlight key issues as it pertains to these topics. So I'm going to begin with a little bit of history and definition. So we think about what was the impetus behind cross-battery assessment. Well, Richard Woodcock published an article in 1990. It was a series of joint factor analytic studies with the WJ tests and tests from other cognitive batteries. And basically, the results of his joint factor analyses demonstrated that the WJR measured 8 broad fluid crystallized cognitive abilities, while all the other intelligence tests included in these joint factor analyses measured anywhere between 3 and 5, which was a pretty large difference. And so one of his conclusions was if you're not using the WJR, then you probably are going to need to cross batteries in order to obtain the information necessary for a particular evaluation. And so that really sparked the idea of cross-battery assessment. There's always been a need for cross-battery assessment. In his book on intelligent testing with the WISC-3, said, a WISC-3 detective strives to use ingenuity, clinical sense, a thorough grounding in psychological theory and research, and a willingness to administer supplementary cognitive tests to reveal the dynamics of a child's scaled score profile. So when we looked at our tests, all tests that were published prior to 2000, and we looked at what those tests measure according to the fluid crystallized theory, which at the time was comprised of approximately 10 broad, anywhere between 8 and 10 broad cognitive abilities. Basically, we found that there were a lot of abilities that were not measured by our major cognitive and intelligence tests. And also, a number of abilities were underrepresented, meaning that they were not sufficiently broad to be able to draw inferences about performance in particular cognitive domains. So basically, there are a lot of holes in our battery. And you may say, well, why does that matter? Why does it matter if tests don't measure this ability or that ability? Well, we always want to look to the referral. And if, since I'm talking to a group of school psychologists, we know that in the schools, a very large number of referrals come from individuals who are suspected of having a specific learning disability, and more often than not in the area of reading. And so many of the abilities and processes that are not assessed by these tests at the time were important for understanding learning difficulties. So there was a real need in our field to systematically augment these cognitive batteries in a way that was psychometrically and theoretically defensible, such that a broader range of abilities and processes could be measured, thereby doing a better job of answering referral concerns. So what was happening in the field in the earliest days of cross-battery assessments, so the late 1990s? Well, the tests that we were using had sources of invalidity, right? So there was invalidity in assessment. And the types of invalidity in assessment that were prevalent were called construct underrepresentation and construct irrelevant variance. So these sources of invalidity were problematic in assessment for many years, and two books that addressed the issue addressed it through the introduction of cross-battery assessment. And so Contemporary Intellectual Assessment, which was published in 1997, contained a chapter on battery assessment, talking specifically about issues of construct underrepresentation and construct irrelevant variance, and how cross-battery assessment can circumvent those sources of invalidity in assessment. And the Intelligence Test Desk Reference that I co-authored with Kevin McGrew was the first book that really laid out step-by-step how to do cross-battery assessment. So I wanted to mention that Kevin McGrew is really instrumental in the development of the original cross-battery work. He's also was an author of WJ3 and a current author of the WJ4. And his contributions, he's had many, but just to highlight a couple, he was really instrumental in bringing fluid crystallized theory to the field of school psychology, for conducting the analyses that eventually led to CHC theory, that is, analyses that attempted to resolve differences between the Horn-Cattell fluid crystallized model and John Carroll's three-stratum theory of cognitive assessment or cognitive abilities. And he also was a big advocate of better construct representation on intelligence and cognitive ability tests. So a lot of that knowledge really informed the initial development of cross-battery assessment. According to Messick, construct irrelevant variance happens when an assessment is too broad, containing excess reliable variance associated with other distinct constructs that affects responses in a manner that's irrelevant to the interpreted construct. And one of the main goals of cross-battery assessment was to improve upon the construct validity of test composites. And after reviewing the cross-battery assessment approach that was in the Intelligence Test Desk reference, John Carroll, which is the second C in CHC theory, in his review, he said, in the past, there have been problems in training psychologists to use proper procedures and judgment in administering individual intelligence tests, with the result that many mistakes have been made. This book has every chance of assisting in the proper training and proper guidance of those who use individual intelligence and cognitive ability tests. And that was written almost 20 years ago. And since that time, my colleagues and I have engaged in a systematic program of research where we follow the theory, we follow the research, and we use the latest developments in theory and research to inform cross-battery assessment. So it's ongoing work, it's not static. Here's an example of what is meant by construct irrelevant variance. I don't know how many are listening. Remember verbal IQ, performance IQ on the Wechslers. But here's an example of performance IQ made up of five subtests. Most of those subtests measure aspects of visual processing, although two of those visual processing tests also rely fairly heavily on crystallized knowledge. And then there was another test that was part of the performance IQ, which was coding. And coding is a measure of processing speed. So it's not that coding is not a good test. It doesn't contribute to our understanding of strengths and weaknesses for an individual. However, coding is measuring something that's largely irrelevant to the intended construct underlying that performance IQ, which is largely visual processing. So on the WISC-3, the Perceptual Organization Index was really the best estimate of GV, whereas the performance IQ contained construct irrelevant variance. So another source of invalidity assessment is construct underrepresentation. And that occurs when too few features, that is narrow abilities, are evaluated in the measurement of a construct, or when a composite includes two or more measures of the same narrow ability. So if you're intending to assess GV and you would like to make an interpretation about an individual's fluid reasoning, then you need at least two qualitatively different indicators of GF in order to be able to draw inferences about performance in that broad ability domain. So if you only have one, in this case, concept formation, that information that you derive from the concept formation score is not sufficiently broad to allow us to draw conclusions about GF, broad GF. Rather, we can speak just more narrowly about inductive reasoning from that subtest. So in order for you to have adequate representation of GF, you need at least two qualitatively different indicators. So concept formation plus number series, one measure of inductive reasoning, a second measure of quantitative reasoning, so two qualitatively different indicators, that composite then allows you to draw inferences about the broader area, that is fluid reasoning. Now, you can also have two subtests but still have construct underrepresentation. For example, on the KBC2, Rebus and Atlantis are both measures of associative memory. And so associative memory plus associative memory is associative memory, not allowing us to draw inferences about a broader cognitive domain, in this case, long-term storage and retrieval. So to represent a broad ability adequately, not one subtest, but two subtests that measure two qualitatively different indicators or aspects of the broad ability, that provides adequate representation. Also, you can have two subtests, but if they're the measures of the same narrow ability, then you cannot draw inferences about the broad ability. You need two qualitatively different indicators for that to happen. Same is true at the narrow ability level. So a single subtest of a narrow ability, particularly when it's low, like below average, not a good measure of the narrow ability, because we're not really sure why that test is low. We really don't have enough information. At least two measures, similar measures of the same narrow ability, so in this case, Rebus and Atlantis, that composite allows us to draw inferences about the narrow ability of associative memory. So in terms of representation of CHC abilities on our tests, well, a lot of tests, either the ability, there were a number of abilities that were not adequately measured, and some that were underrepresented. So basically, depending on the referral, if you needed to broaden your assessment so that it measured some abilities and processes that were considered important in understanding the referral, the best way to do it would be to use subtests from another battery to systematically augment your core battery. So most people were using the Wechslers. Prior to 2000, the Wechslers were the gold standard. They were, you know, the most popular test used the world over. And regardless of what it measured or didn't measure, that was the core battery. So to expand it to measure GF, we had to take tests from another battery, underrepresented tests, or constructs, and constructs that were not measured. So, you know, if you look at this slide, and probably an obvious question is, well, why would you use the WISC-3 when the WJR or the WJ-3 actually measures a broader range of cognitive abilities and processes? So why not just use that instrument instead of the Wechslers? Well, we really tried that. We took that road for a while and tried to get people to switch, but the Wechsler tests were way too entrenched in our field. According to John Carroll, presently available knowledge and technology would permit the development of tests and scales that would be much more adequate for their purposes than the Wechsler scales. And again, this is talking about WISC-R, WISC-3, not present day yet, WISC-R, WISC-3. So there was, you know, clearly a need for better construct representation on tests. And, you know, we could move to WJR, WJ3 for that, but they were just not well understood batteries at the time. According to John Horn in the technical manual of the WJR, he wrote, useful technology is based on scientific understanding. The better the science, the more effective the technology can be. So it is with psychological tests. They should be based on the most dependable and current evidence of science. And so, as I was saying, the WJR and WJ3 WJR was seldom used. WJ3, you know, it started to become more popular, and it did. It became actually quite popular among individuals who conducted cross-battery assessment, and that's because it measured the broadest range of cognitive abilities. So, any other cognitive test you may have been using at the time, the WJ3 was really your go-to battery for augmenting it if you did not use it as your core battery. According to Brown in 1994, it is amazing how reluctant the profession has been in adopting more modern theories of intellectual development. So as I said, we tried to say, hey, you know, there's a better test out here. Why don't you, in terms of measuring a broader range of cognitive abilities and processes, all tests have strengths and limitations, but you know, we were trying to get people to think outside of the box a little bit more and try other assessments other than the Wechsler, and we weren't successful at that. But then we thought, well, maybe it's not necessary to try to get people to switch. How about we just have them, you know, try to use cross-battery principles and procedures? And then what did that entail? Well, basically, asking the question, what are the Wechslers measure according to fluid and crystallized theory? So this is a WISC-3 example, measures GC, GV, GSM, and GS. Well, what's missing? GF is missing, GLR is missing, GA is missing, so fluid reasoning, long-term storage and retrieval, and auditory processing, and short-term memory is underrepresented. And then, well, what abilities and processes are necessary to assess based on the referral? Well, if the referral is suspected SLD, then we know that across most of these areas, there are specific narrow abilities and processes that are important in understanding reading, math, writing, achievement. So the idea then would be to use the best of the Wechslers and then systematically supplement with tests from another battery or batteries so that you obtain a broader measure of abilities and processes important for the referral, and to do it in approximately the same amount of time as it would take to administer a single battery. So basically, the definition of cross-battery assessment is that it's a time-efficient method of organizing and interpreting cognitive and academic abilities and neuropsych processes using more than one instrument in a manner that is psychometrically and theoretically defensible. It allows practitioners to measure reliably a wider or a more in-depth and perhaps selective range of cognitive abilities, processes, and so forth, than that represented by any given standalone assessment battery. So XBA really was used or is used to systematically fill the holes in ability batteries to increase the breadth and the depth of measurement required by a referral. Okay, we can look at the construct representation of the Wechslers beginning in 1974. Three areas not represented were auditory processing, long-term storage and retrieval, and fluid reasoning. Abilities there underrepresented, and adequate representation of GC and GV only. In 1991, when the WISC-3 was published, there were 17 years between the WISC-R and the WISC-3. And I think what struck most people when the WISC-3 was published is that, you know, there were a lot of sort of cosmetic changes, new norms, color, all kinds of things with the WISC-3. But when it came to the construct representation, we really got better measurement of processing speed, and that was really it. And so people were a little disappointed with that. And there was a special issue in the Journal of Psychoeducational Assessment, including critical reviews of the WISC-3. And mainly that was basically what cut across all the reviews of the WISC-3, that it really didn't change much in 17 years. VIQ, PIQ were still part of the battery. Construct, irrelevant variance. Right around sometime between WISC-3, WISC-4, it was when cross-battery entered the field. WISC-4, it was a pretty substantial, the most substantial revision of any Wechsler test. And VIQ, PIQ were dropped. Better representation of GF, representation or adequate representation now of GSM. And then finally, with the most current WISC-5, you see it very much in line with other tests that adhere at least somewhat to CHC theory, where now you have adequate representation of six broad cognitive abilities, which is really substantial, and it's an excellent instrument. Now, the most current contributions of the cross-battery approach are in Essentials of Cross-Battery Assessment, 3rd edition, where you see a lot of refinements and extensions to this method, significantly improved evidence base, significantly improved and expanded software programs. When we first published cross-battery assessment, we published worksheets that you fill out, paper and pencil worksheets. In the second edition of cross-battery assessment, we included like Excel-based programs to facilitate the process of crossing batteries. We significantly improved upon those programs in the third edition, and there were three separate programs: the Data Management and Interpretive Assistant, which helped ensure that abilities and constructs were well represented; the Pattern of Strengths and Weaknesses Analyzer, which provided some assistance in understanding information that could help inform SLD diagnosis; and the Culture Language Interpretive Matrix, which is a clinical tool to give you some guidance on the extent to which it is likely that your test findings are valid for individuals who are English learners. Well, we took those three programs, we improved upon them again, we integrated them into one software system, and that software system we call XBAS, Cross-Battery Assessment Software System, and it improves, greatly improved the functionality of the programs and also the psychometrics behind the cross-battery approach. Now, there are several foundational sources of information that underlie cross-battery assessment. So one is CHC theory. So CHC theory, now the Raymond Cattell, John Horn, and John Carroll have all passed. And so Kevin McGrew really has taken the lead on ensuring that CHC stays current and that and he has published 2005. He did an update of CHC theory in 2012 in Contemporary Intellectual Assessment, third edition. He teamed up with Joel Schneider. Again, more revisions and refinements to the theory. And most recently, in the fourth edition, both Joel Schneider and Kevin McGrew teamed up again and did a really substantial and nice overview and streamlining, refining, and revising CHC to keep it current with the research. So CHC theory underlies cross-battery assessment. Now, cross-battery assessment started out largely as a classification system, and the classification system, that is classifying tests at the broad ability level and at the narrow ability level, were necessary to guard against those sources of invalidity in assessment. So the broad stratum 2 test classifications, in other words, is the test, the GF test, the GC test, et cetera, that was necessary to guard against construct irrelevant variants. And these broad ability classifications were based on theory-driven cross-battery factor analyses. If you want to look at and get a better sense of what those analyses look like and how they helped inform classifications, you can look at this particular study and summary of the theory-driven cross-battery factor analyses from 1990 to 2014. The narrow ability classification, so yes, it's a measure of GF, but what is it more specifically? Is it an inductive reasoning test? Is it deductive reasoning test? Is it a quantitative reasoning test? Well, those kinds of classifications were necessary to guard against construct underrepresentation. And narrow ability classifications are based more on expert consensus or content validity studies, the very first of which was done by Kevin McGrew in 1997 in the original Contemporary Intellectual Assessment. We've published the results of a expert consensus study in Essentials of Cross-Battery Assessment in Appendix L, and we did this because in the third edition we had over 300 new subtests from the previous edition, so we did an expert consensus study there. Now, this particular slide shows all of our current instruments. And as you can see, there's a lot less of a need for cross-battery assessment because our tests are getting better and better. They're measuring a broader range of abilities. They're measuring broad abilities more adequately. They're also measuring certain narrow abilities adequately. So there's less of a need for cross-battery. If you look at the area that is most underrepresented or not measured, it's GA. Usually when we talk about GA, auditory processing, we're mainly talking about phonetic coding or phonological processing, and we usually get that information not so much from our intelligence tests, but from more special purpose tests like the comprehensive test of phonological processing, for example. So we're doing a much better job in terms of construct representation in our field. We also did classifications of tests by neuropsych domain, and we used our own an analysis of these tests according to neuropsych domains, and then we cross-check them with Dan Miller's classifications in Essentials of School Neuropsych Assessment. And so we present those in our cross-battery book as well. According to Scott Decker, he says CHC theory and its operationalization in a cross-battery assessment procedure may improve school psych assessment practice and facilitate the integration of neuropsychological methodology in school-based assessments. The CHC model benefits from more than a half century of validity research on psychometric, developmental, heritability, academic outcome, and neurocognitive evidence. He goes on to say that CHC and cross-battery assessment approaches shift assessment practice from IQ composites to neurodevelopmental functions. This transition can be facilitated by training in contemporary psychometric models. Furthermore, integrating cross-battery assessment approaches with a global hypothesis testing approach may provide the best alternative method that meets federal requirements for a comprehensive evaluation. And then finally, a really important foundation of cross-battery assessment are the relations among cognitive abilities, neuropsych processes, and specific academic skills. These relationships are important for informing, particularly for informing diagnosis of specific learning disabilities, and also for developing educational strategies and selecting and tailoring interventions. So this next slide here shows, basically it's a summary of the relations between CHC abilities, processes, and specific academic areas in reading, math, and written language. And so down the left-hand column are seven broad cognitive abilities from CHC theory. And within the body of this table are the narrow abilities within each of those areas that have been found to be most closely associated with reading, math, and writing achievement. So when we get a reading referral, for example, we can look down that first column and say, okay, which specific narrow abilities within each of these broad areas may be the ones that are most important to assess to help me understand whether or not there are some underlying cognitive processing problems that might be associated with the individual's difficulty acquiring and developing basic reading skills, for example. Now, in terms of the assessment intervention connection, you want to consider your referral information, so which abilities and processes are most important to assess, and then follow the XBA principles and procedures to ensure adequate representation of the most important broad and narrow abilities and processes. Now, once you do that, you're going to obtain a profile of strengths and weaknesses, and those weaknesses that you may uncover or deficits that you may uncover really don't mean much unless you can identify how they manifest for the individual. And once you identify how a weakness manifests for the individual, it actually does two things. It brings ecological validity to your test scores, and it also provides a target for intervention. And once you have a target for intervention, then it becomes much more clear in terms of what are the things that are necessary to minimize or attempt to bypass the effects of the cognitive deficits so that the student has greater access to the curriculum and instruction. So it sort of works like this. So you have fluid reasoning, you're assessing fluid reasoning, you need to know what fluid reasoning is, how to explain it in user-friendly terms, let's say, to teachers, to parents, refers to a type of thinking that an individual may use when faced with a relatively new task that cannot be performed automatically. One of the best ways to explain these areas of GF, GC, GLR, GV is to give examples, forming and recognizing concepts, and how are dog and cat alike, how are they the same? identifying and perceiving relationships, drawing inferences, and so forth. So once you start giving examples of what you mean by fluid reasoning, teachers in particular can say, oh yeah, we do that in science class, or, you know, and they'll begin to make connections. And that's what you want. You want teachers to help make connections, because when teachers make connections, they can help you understand how your data that may have demonstrated a weakness or a deficit, how it does in fact manifest in the classroom in, you know, real world settings for the child. So fluid reasoning is made up of three narrow abilities in particular: induction, general sequential reasoning or deduction, and quantitative reasoning. The WJ4, for example, measures each one of these areas, as does the WISC-5. Now, in terms of the relationship between fluid reasoning and reading achievement, well, fluid reasoning is not involved in the development of basic reading skills. So when that curriculum shifts from learning to read to reading to learn, that's where GF comes in, because GF is related more to higher level skills, application skills like reading comprehension, drawing inferences from text, making predictions, comparing and contrasting. That's where GF is going to come in, play a moderate role in reading comprehension. Also involved in reading comprehension are other issues like executive functions such as planning, organization, self-monitoring. In terms of math achievement, well, not surprising, GF has its strongest relationship to math achievement, because part of GF is indeed reasoning with quantitative information. And GF also plays a role in written language or writing achievement, but again, more higher level writing, essay writing, persuasive writing, that sort of thing. So the idea is, if I'm measuring fluid reasoning, I need to know what it is. And that's what we're seeing on this slide here, fluid reasoning. Here's a brief definition. And then if I do, in fact, obtain a low score on GF, what does that mean in terms of how can we expect a fluid reasoning deficit to manifest for the individual? The individual may have difficulties with higher level thinking and reasoning, with transferring or generalizing learning, deriving solutions to novel problems, things of that nature. And then more specifically, what will we see in reading, in math, in written language? So we're sort of drilling down and saying, hey, do we really have ecological validity for a low score in GF? And these are some general and specific ways in which a reasoning deficit would manifest for an individual. Once you identify the manifestation, again, that brings ecological validity support for your GF score or scores, and it also gives you a target for intervention. So once you know how it's affecting the child in the classroom, then what are some of the things that you can do? So, you know, use demonstrations to externalize the reasoning process, like think alouds. Direct the student to, you know, look at instructional materials, the books that the student is using. Some books have expanded answer keys containing the reason for correct and incorrect choices, which would be a great tool for an individual who struggles with reasoning. Problem-solving charts, use of mnemonics, graphic organizers, concept maps, all kinds of strategies, instructional materials, and so forth. So again, by minimizing the effects of a reasoning deficit through, you know, classroom, instructional, environmental, compensatory strategies, by minimizing the effects, then the student has greater access to the instruction and the curriculum. Now, you know, most people say, well, hey, if the child's struggling in reading, teach the child how to read, right? What does that mean? It's an academic area of weakness. Give them an evidence-based, scientifically-based program, remedial program, right? Well, yes, absolutely. That's what we do. And RTI helps us do it early on through universal screening, identifying children who are at risk. We want to get them immediately into good evidence-based programs. However, Some children also have cognitive areas of weakness or deficiency. It may be in broad abilities, maybe in narrow abilities, and those cognitive areas of deficiency have general manifestations and have specific manifestations in reading, math, and writing. And there are things that we can do in addition to remedial programs to support the child's learning through strategies, techniques, and supports for the learner. And depending on the extent of the manifestations, it gives us some idea of the educational impact. And the greater the educational impact, the more wraparound services we're likely to need for the student. And so strategies are for the learner, techniques are for teachers and parents, and then there's a variety of different supports for the learner, including e-learning tools, apps, web-based programs, accommodations, modifications, and so on. So it's not just good enough to say the child has this academic deficit, give them a remedial program. That may work for many children. It's probably not going to work for all. And that's why we need to look when we're not having a positive response or the expected response to an evidence-based program, we need to look further and say, what else is happening? And do we see evidence of manifestations of cognitive abilities and processing weaknesses or deficits? Because if we do, we can certainly do things to help minimize the effects of those deficits. Different combinations of abilities are important for different achievements. So, for example, students who learn well, who excel academically, they have good GC, a good fund of knowledge, good vocabulary. They're able to communicate well. They are efficient learners. They're able to retrieve information fluently. And they're able to retrieve information from long-term stores, hold that information, interact it with new information, transform it in some way, and draw conclusions based on inductive and deductive reasoning. So GF, GC, and those memory abilities are really key to overall academic success in school. Knowing something about where the child performs in these four areas in particular gives us valuable information about how to help the child. Now, a couple of misconceptions, terminology issues. Cross-battery assessment is not the same thing as PSW, pattern of strengths and weaknesses, but they have been used interchangeably. They are different. They're two different things, but they are compatible. They're often used together. So because they've been confused, we gave our operational definition of specific learning disabilities a name, and we call it the dual discrepancy consistency operational definition. So cross-battery assessment is about combining tests from different batteries. It predates our PSW model, which is the dual discrepancy consistency model. Okay, the other thing that I wanted to say is that PSW does not diagnose SLD. We cannot diagnose SLD with a formula. If we're using PSW, we ought to be using it to inform our diagnosis, not to make the diagnosis for us. And I think that's an important distinction. Okay. There's a lot of controversy about PSW models. So because they're becoming more popular, we're now seeing more research. And so there's one sort of body of research that's emerging that has identified, or has said that PSW models or found that PSW models lack agreement. And that is true. You use different PSW models and you're identifying different children in the same way that ability achievement discrepancy. You use different critical values for ability achievement discrepancy, you identify different kids. Same thing is true for RTI. RTI is a discrepancy-based model. It's a dual discrepancy model. It's discrepancy in rate of learning and level of learning. So there are different ways of identifying rate and level. So use different criteria, you're identifying different children. So all of these models, all of these approaches are quantitatively based. They're all discrepancy based. And so they're all going to have a lack of agreement. So that's valuable. that's valuable information. There are some potential weaknesses to PSW, but it's not unique to PSW. There's another body of research that shows that PSW methods are relevant for differential diagnosis of learning disabilities in reading, math, and written expression. And so there are some valid points that are made in that body of research. And so there are valid points that are made for and against PSW models, and the results of the studies that have been published are impacted by methodological preferences used to analyze the data, as well as the accuracy or inaccuracy of the assumptions made about each PSW model. So we're really seeing, you know, two lines of PSW research, and we're not in a position right now to say, you know, we can't use it, let's throw the baby out with the bathwater. There will be arguments both for and against PSW over the next several years. All methods have limitations, as I said. PSW is no excuse. Nevertheless, it most certainly can be used effectively to inform SLD diagnosis. Multiple data sources, multiple data gathering methods. PSW provides quantitative information. It doesn't diagnose the problem. There are a number of different PSW methods. I just want to talk very briefly about the dual discrepancy consistency method. Basically, with dual discrepancy consistency, there's evidence of cognitive weakness or deficit. There's evidence of academic weakness or deficit. And there's evidence of at least average overall cognitive ability to think and reason, despite the cognitive processing identified cognitive processing areas of weakness. And there's a consistency between your cognitive areas of weakness and your academic areas of weakness, which basically means that there's an empirically established relationship between the areas of cognitive weakness and the areas of academic weakness, or an ecologically valid one. There's also a discrepancy between your cognitive areas of strength and your cognitive areas of weakness, or in the DDC model, your estimate of overall cognitive ability. And so this discrepancy is basically to determine that there is, in fact, a reliable difference, that difference is not due to chance. Same thing between your cognitive strengths and your academic weaknesses, that is a reliable difference that's not due to chance. Now, the fact that you simply have a discrepancy between overall estimate of overall cognitive ability and cognitive weakness only means that difference is real, but that difference may occur in a rather substantial portion of the population. So in our model, we also say that it has to be domain specific. And I'll explain that in a minute. And also the other discrepancy between overall ability, estimate of overall ability and academic weakness. That could be also a significant difference, but a difference that occurs in a quite a substantial amount of the population. Therefore, we also say that it has to be unexpected underachievement. Unexpected underachievement would mean that that's based on base rate data. Okay, so in our operational definition, there's evidence of an academic weakness. You can call an academic weakness anything you really want, you know, but mostly people say, you know, it's below average performance. Below average performance in and of itself is not domain specific or is not unexpected underachievement. So just because you have a low academic score doesn't mean it's unexpected. So it's not just, hey, the score was below 90, or hey, the score was below 85, or whatever cut point somebody sets, but also it needs to be unexpected, which is where the base rate data come in. Exclusionary factors is a very important part of PSW analysis, and it needs to augment the PSW analysis. In other words, you need both. So it's not just, okay, here's the pattern and the pattern supports SLD. Well, what about the exclusionary factors? And was that a systematic review of these exclusionary factors? And on what basis did you make the determination that these factors were not the primary cause of the academic skill weaknesses? So that's a very important component. Cognitive weakness, again, below average score, standard deviation below, whatever your cut score may be, That in and of itself does not constitute a domain-specific weakness, because the domain-specific weakness brings in the base rate data. Okay. And then level four of our operational definition is really the PSW piece, and that's the dual discrepancy consistency. And the first discrepancy is, it looks at basically a discrepancy between predicted and actual performance in the cognitive area in question. And if that difference between the predicted and actual performance occurs at about 10% or less of the population, that's when it becomes considered domain specific. The second discrepancy is a difference between predicted and actual achievement in the area in question. And if that difference between predicted and actual achievement occurs in about 10% or less of the population, that provides support for unexpected underachievement. And then the consistency has to do with the relationship between the cognitive weakness and the academic weakness. That is it an empirical or ecologically valid relationship? Now, in order to determine these, use the base rates and determine whether there's unusual differences and so forth, you need XBAS, because the decisions that are made in the XBAS program are made student by student by student by student. So students have different strengths and weaknesses, and their data are analyzed in this program, and regression-based analyses are used and so forth. Different reliabilities are generated. Formulas are used based on median reliabilities, median intercorrelations, and so forth. And it's all individually based depending on where your strengths and weaknesses are and so forth. So that's why you need the software program to do the analysis. Now, one thing that I would like to point out, and I think that this is pretty important because it's something that has been published, and that is that this relationship between the cognitive areas of weakness and the academic areas of weakness were basically erroneously assumed by Kranzer and his colleagues in one of the studies that they did, that this relationship was deterministic. That is, if you have a cognitive weakness, you must have an academic weakness. And if you have an academic weakness, you must have a cognitive weakness. That's not the way it works. It's not a deterministic relationship, it's probabilistic. And what does that mean? That means that cognitive processing weaknesses raise the risk of academic skill weaknesses, but they do not guarantee them, right? So many children have cognitive processing weaknesses, but they figured out a way around it such that they're performing okay academically, so they never make it to our office, you know, to a comprehensive evaluation. And academic skill weaknesses can occur without any cognitive processing weaknesses because there are so many other things that can interfere with academic performance. So we're talking about a probabilistic relationship here. Cognitive processing weaknesses raise the risk of academic weaknesses. They do not guarantee them. I see that I'm running out of time, so I'm just going to maybe go a little bit more quickly, if that's even possible. In order to interpret a PSW output, any PSW output, I believe it requires an understanding of contemporary theory, an understanding of the theoretical constructs that are measured by the cognitive batteries, an understanding of the cognitive processes and abilities that are related to achievement. It may require cross-battery assessment in order to assess all the abilities and processes considered important based on the referral, to follow up on aberrant score performances and so forth. And it requires an understanding of the SLD construct. So in terms of theory, for our dual discrepancy consistency model, within the context of our operational definition of LD, we're mainly focused on CHC theory. In terms of the theoretical constructs that are measured by cognitive batteries, whatever battery you choose to use as your core battery, you need to understand what it measures. Those subtests, what narrow abilities do they measure? And when those narrow abilities come together and form composites, how are those composites interpreted? Are they interpreted as narrow ability composites, broad ability composites? You need to understand that. And regardless of what test you're using, you need to understand those broad and narrow abilities that are assessed. Requires an understanding of cognitive processes and abilities related to achievement. Well, we talked about that set of relationships that are largely correlational in the literature. Cross-battery assessment, we talked about that. You have a significant difference between two areas that measure visual processing. One's average, one's well below average. Well, do I know that this is an individual with a visual memory problem? Well, that's a low score, but it could be low for a number of reasons. So I want to follow up. I can't follow up on another test. This is a WJ example. I can't follow up with another test from the WJ because the WJ doesn't include another measure of visual memory. So I need to go add a battery. I need to look at, hey, what visual memory tests are out there? Oh, I have the TOML in my district, and I see that that test has three measures of visual memory. So I can use the TOML to supplement and follow up on my visual memory subtest. Okay, requires an understanding of the SLD construct. We first started talking about our operational definition of specific learning disability in 2002, and ever since then we continue to revise and update it based on revisions to theory, new research, and finally in 2013, because the PSW literature started talking about the XBA method. No, it's the PSW method. Again, they're not the same thing. So it's our dual discrepancy consistency method. So we named it in our Cross Battery third edition book. In that book, you'll see the operational definition, the five levels of the operational definition, and the criteria. I'm going to just go through very quickly now. XBAS, open XBAS, go to the start. And if you gave the WISC-V, you're right there. You enter your WISC-V scores. It gives you information on cohesion, whether or not your composites are good summaries of the theoretically related abilities they were intended to represent, whether or not follow-up assessment is necessary in any particular area. You can transfer your scores over to what we call a data organizer, the data organizer tab, where all of your best estimates of GF, GC, GLR are all moved over to the organizer tab. All your achievement data can be moved over to the data organizer tab, either subtest by subtest or composite by composite. If you supplement your WISC-V, let's say in this example with the CTOP-2, in the area of GA, you can enter those data into XBAS, have those data analyzed, transfer those data over to the Data Organizer tab. Once you're over on the Data Organizer tab, you can see all the cognitive areas that were transferred over, 7 estimates in all. All the achievement areas that were transferred to this Data Organizer tab, 8 subtests or composites in all. There's no requirement that you have to measure all 8 areas of LD. It's district guidelines or your own preference. You actually only need one area of academic achievement to run a PSW analysis, although you do need at least one estimate in 7 CHC domains to run the PSW analysis. You need to identify, this is a clinical tool, so you need to use clinical judgment, and you need to identify all of your areas as either strengths or weaknesses, and we typically talk about whether or not these are areas that are likely facilitating learning. They tend to be strengths. Areas that may be inhibiting learning are weaknesses. The program gives us some values that I'm not don't have enough time to talk about right now, but they are explained in most of our writings. A G value, which is the gives you an indication of whether the areas that you said were strengths, that there's enough of them and they're the right areas so that you can say with a degree of certainty that this is an individual who is very likely to have at least average overall ability to think and reason despite some specific cognitive processing deficits. And then the facilitating cognitive composite is that estimate of overall ability. It's an estimate of the areas that you said were strengths, but they have to be sufficient in breadth and the right ones in order to be considered a good proxy of G, or overall ability to think and reason. And then finally, you get your analysis, and your analysis tells you whether or not you have a significant difference between your cognitive areas of strength, which is your facilitating cognitive composite, your cognitive area of weakness, strengths, your academic area of weakness. Yes, these differences are statistically significant, but are they also unusual? So the program uses the overall cognitive area of the estimate of G, or general intelligence, overall ability to think and reason, uses it in a regression-based formula to predict where the person is expected to perform in the cognitive area of weakness, takes the looks at the difference, compares that difference between predicted and actual, compares it to a critical value. It meets or exceeds the critical value. That means that that difference occurs in about 10% or less of the population, meaning that it's domain specific. Over on this side, difference between predicted and actual academic achievement, in this case, in the area of reading comprehension, that difference meets or exceeds the critical value. Difference between predicted and actual occurs in about 10% or less of the population, so that's unexpected underachievement. And then what the program does is it, in this drop-down menu are all the areas that you said were weaknesses. It looks at those areas, and it then says, it compares them to this area, academic area of weakness, and it says, is there an empirical relationship? And it says the strength of that relationship is high. So there's an empirically established relationship between those areas and reading achievement, or most of those areas in reading achievement. And then it looks at, are they both weaknesses? So that performance relative to most people, 74 here, 80 here, yes, those are both weaknesses relative to most people. So those weaknesses, the strength of the relationship together gives us the answer to, is there a below average aptitude achievement consistency? And this says, yes, there is. You scroll down in the XPass and you get answers to the questions related to SLD. You can print the results. All of the analyses that are conducted for the PSW analysis and XPass are the most psychometrically defensible in terms of looking at score differences and the way in which we look at score differences specifically for the purpose of assisting in SLD identification. And I'm going to pretty much wrap up right now. Identification of specific learning disabilities involves more than just examining scores from standardized tests. You need a convergence of data sources. Data should be gathered through different methods. Exclusionary factors must be considered and examined systematically. There are strengths and weaknesses, as I said, to all methods, including cross-battery, including PSW. The strengths of cross-battery is that it's firmly grounded in contemporary CHC theory and its strong research base. It improves communication among professionals by having a common set of terms and definitions. It's psychometrically defensible. It facilitates evaluation of students suspected of having learning disabilities. It facilitates evaluation of English learners. It's flexible and it's automated. Weaknesses, there is not a common norm group, but the cross-battery composites are psychometrically sound and theoretically defensible. We gathered over 2,500 reliability coefficients and intercorrelations to calculate medians that we use in standard formulas to create composites. So the composites really mimic actual norms. It may require professional development training. So there's a high degree of theoretical and psychometric rigor behind this method, and you often don't find that in training programs. It may be time consuming, particularly in the beginning when you're first learning how to use it, and trying to figure out, you know, whether or not you can interpret certain composites. You need to follow up on those composites. The more familiar you are with the approach, the more confident you are in your assessment practices, you know, as you become more familiar with it, then it can indeed be a time-efficient method for gathering data. There's no litmus test for SLD identification. The more well-versed you are in different approaches and methods, the more information you will gain about the student, including how best to help him or her. If you're interested in more information about XBA or XPass, we do have our program, our resources, our books, our software, and so forth. Thank you very much.
Wow.
Thank you so much.
That was like so much information. My brain is just like, it takes a little bit of time for it to soak in. That was amazing.
Thank you. I'm sorry I went a little bit over.
Oh, no, you're okay. So we do have a couple questions, if you don't mind staying a little bit longer with us.
Sure. Because
our audience does have a couple of questions. And I wanted to say, too, that Rebecca has now joined us. Hey, Rebecca.
Hi, Dr. Flanagan. Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Let me start with the first one. I've got questions myself, but I'm just going to defer right now in the interest of time. We'll go to our audience here. So Robert wants to know, how do you differentiate between oral expression and listening comprehension as an academic skill versus a cognitive ability, usually GC?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It sounds like somebody who's using this for PSW analysis. The tests of listening comprehension, while they are found on achievement batteries, they're part of GC. So listening comprehension measures LS, listening ability, which is a narrow ability subsumed by GC. And oral expression is also measured on achievement tests, but it's also part of GC. It's called communication abilities in the area of GC. So I think what's most important in PSW is that, you know, when you're using a program like the one that I described, that you don't use cognitive areas to predict academic areas. So using GC to predict listening comprehension, oral expression, you know, let's say in those two bottom ovals, doesn't make sense because you basically have the same construct on both sides, right? So GC, you know, part of GC is listening comprehension, oral expression, and then you have listening comprehension, oral expression as your areas of weakness. You know, you have to figure out, you know, where do you want to put them? And if you're talking about listening comprehension, oral expression as academic areas, then you can't use GC to predict that and say that that's, you know, evidence of a specific learning disability, because it doesn't make sense. You're in a sense double dipping. And I think that that may be where that question is going.
Thank you. We have a follow-up question to that. How does attention fit into the DDC model and the XBAS as measured by tools such as the NEPSI-2 or rating scales such as the Connors-3?
Okay, so the NEPSI is part of XBAS. XBAS includes approximately 135 batteries and over 1,000 subtests. And the NEPSI-2 is part of that. And if there are some areas that that we call neuropsych areas. And so one is cognitive efficiency. And it's in that cognitive efficiency area that you're likely to see those tests that are more attention oriented. So that's where you would find those. In terms of behavior rating scales, we have not yet included behavior rating scales in XBAS. So XBAS has the quantitative, you know, data from psychometric tests, you know, like cognitive achievement, language, neuropsych, but rating scales we have not included yet, although we have recently been discussing that option as we move forward and continue to build on and expand XBAS.
We have in the chat on YouTube Live, there's like just tons of discussion going on. People are saying they love XBAS, like I've never used it, but I want to now. And we have a question from Serena, Dr. Flanagan, is it possible to find end users of the XBAS who also have a background in programming in order to make the software more intuitive, user-friendly when you make the next update?
Excellent question. You know, it's interesting because when we first started doing Cross Battery, we didn't have a very big following. In fact, our first Cross Battery book, which was Essentials Cross Battery First Edition, we had worksheets. And so maybe four people in the country were using those worksheets because who wants to use worksheets? And so we started to automate it. And so once we started automating it and just these very basic kind of Excel programs, people started using it more because it was more efficient. And so from that time forward, we've just been building and building and building on these Excel programs. Now, once we published XBAS, a lot more people just grabbed XBAS without having knowledge of cross-battery assessment. And then they were like, whoa, what is this all about? Like, I don't understand it. It's not very intuitive. And so we got all that. And one of the things that we did with XBAS is in version 2.0, you'll notice that there's a beginner mode, an intermediate mode, and an advanced mode. If you put it in beginner mode, you will get lots and lots of pop-ups telling you what this tab is for, you know, what the next steps are. And we've basically provided like a built-in tutorial. So you have that feature now in XBAS version 2.0. Going forward, we're going to move XBAS to an online platform. Once it moves to an online platform, we believe that, one, it'll be a lot more intuitive and user-friendly. And two, we can expand it in different ways. So, for example, when it goes online, we're going to have an intervention library. So for whatever your areas of weakness are, academically, cognitively, and what have you, you can select those areas and get information about different ways to intervene.
Awesome. Let's see, I'm checking to see if we have any other, just lots of kind of chatter going on in the YouTube channel, which is awesome. Definitely people are way interested. But I think that looks like, anybody else have any more questions, send them now. But people were talking about it would be nice to be able to cut and paste from scoring software.
Mm-hmm. It would be really nice to be able to do that. I think the potential for XBAS going forward, particularly when it's an online program, I think there'll be a lot more potential in terms of, again, user friendliness, and there's no telling where we might go in terms of, you know, getting it into more widespread use. Mm-hmm. We definitely understand some of the limitations of the program or some of the clunkiness of the program, and you know, have been working tirelessly in trying to remedy some of those problems. We're not programmers, and I want to give a shout out to my colleague Dr. Sam Ortiz, who basically taught himself the ins and outs of programming XBAS to make it do most of the stuff that it does. And so we've recognized that we need to get it to a different platform. And so when it goes online, we think that, you know, we'll iron out a lot of issues and streamline it considerably.
Very cool. And then one other comment, Karis, one of our viewers had indicated or was wondering if you were going to be attending the NAFS 2018 convention. Can we expect to see you there?
Yes. Yes. I'm actually doing a full day, part one and part two on linking assessment to intervention. Mm-hmm. And then I'm involved in, I think, two mini skills presentations.
Awesome.
Wow.
We're hoping we can snag these slides and post them online, if you don't mind, because people are just wanting to review this, and our brains are exploding a little bit because it's a lot of really good information that maybe we got in grad school but couldn't conceptualize at the time or whatever. So if you don't mind emailing these to us, we'd really appreciate it.
I sure can.
Thank you so much, Dr. Flanagan, for coming on tonight. It was amazing and incredible, and we're just grateful for you and your intelligence and what you bring to the field and giving us your time tonight. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Okay.
Thank you.
Night, guys.
Night.